Thank you, Jeannie. And I think I've managed to transcend my first barrier of the meeting, which is to get my slides up. And that's what this meeting is about, transcending barriers, taking care, and making the best of opportunities. And the thesis and the short version of what I'm about to say is indeed that is the opportunities to address sexual health and use sexual health as a part of our toolbox in addressing the problem of STIs will improve patient care and public health. And so my thoughts and my real message here has less to do with the concept of sexual health, which I'll be talking about, and more to do with how to operationalize that, because I think that's sometimes a little bit difficult to grapple with. I should first acknowledge that I have had the great and good fortune to be well-funded in my own opportunities and investigations by NIH, CDC, the World Health Organization, and a number of industry sponsors, none of whom I think will impact what I'm about to say today. But you, of course, have to make that judgment. So the theme of this conference has to do with transcending barriers and making the best of opportunities. And I think that's certainly where we are with U.S. STIs and STI control at this time. If we look carefully, the rates of reportable STIs are flat or even increasing in the case of syphilis and perhaps gonorrhea. We know that one or more Americans has at least one viral STI. HIV is recognized as an STI, and the interface of HIV and STIs as we enter the PrEP era becomes more and more important. And we have more and more opportunities. We have new tools, new diagnostic tools, and more coming. And we have real opportunities to make a difference in the way we approach our patients and patient care. And that's where sexual health comes in. I think it's important to take a step back and figure out how we got to where we are. And if you look at our federal efforts to control STIs, we can create a timeline. Before the 1960s, the CDC and the STD Prevention Branch, which was then called the Venereal Disease Research Laboratory, focused on syphilis. It was public health STD control was syphilis control. In the 1960s, with the advent of new tools, Thayer Martin Media, developed here at the CDC, gonorrhea was added to the agenda. Large evaluations of therapeutic monitoring, gonorrhea therapeutic outcomes and the like, and a national gonorrhea control program. In the 1970s, yet another prominent STI hit the public consciousness, chlamydia. As we had better diagnostic tests to allow us to do that, and to create an infertility prevention program based on and directed at chlamydial infections in women. I should add that always here in the background, and Lynn Barkley mentioned that in her comments yesterday, there were other diseases, LGV, chancroid, and so forth. But these were the major ones, and these were the focus of our federal disease intervention activities. The 1990s, herpes became more and more prominent. The tools and therapies for herpes became important, although it's still not a reportable disease. We also began to focus more on HPV because we had our second great vaccine for prevention of STIs, the first, of course, being the hepatitis B vaccine. And now, as we enter the second decade of the 21st century, we're faced with more than 25 STIs, all the ones I've mentioned, plus Trichomonas with new diagnostic tests for trichomoniasis, dysbiotic STI syndromes like bacterial vaginosis that Dr. Fredericks and Dr. Call both talked about earlier. And yet, as Dr. Boland mentioned yesterday, there was no real change in our funding, or if anything, over the past decade, the funding has actually decreased. So how are we going to do that? What are we going to do? Our nomenclature for referring to STIs has also evolved over that period of time. We first had venereal disease, and that was felt to be an unfriendly term, and so it was changed to sexually transmitted diseases. But that, too, was not such a great term because, indeed, not everybody who is infected is diseases. So until about 10 or 15 years ago, we focused on sexually transmitted infections, right, because not everybody who is infected necessarily has recognizable disease. That suggests the importance of screening and so forth. But in the last 15 years, we've moved more to this concept of sexual health. More on that in a moment. Because I also want to sort of point out and acknowledge, and we need to all acknowledge, that we're still doing the same thing in terms of our efforts to control these problems that were outlined by Thomas Paine in his book, Shadow on the Land, in 1936. And if you think about it, with a little bit of modification and change, this is what we do for any of the diseases we're talking about. HIV, herpes, gonorrhea, chlamydia, on and on and on. Case finding, screening for those who are not aware that they're infected. Prompt therapy, the interval between diagnosis and therapy is crucial. Partner notification, how to do that, how to best accomplish that is one of the major themes that's addressed here again and again and again today in this conference. Mandatory testing for certain groups of populations. Perrin thought that for syphilis, premarital screening as well as prenatal screening was important. We still do routine prenatal screening, don't we? So that's there. And then his fifth point, which is the one that I would posit as the one that we do most poorly and the one that is best addressed by the concept of sexual health, has to do with public education regarding symptoms, complications, and treatment of disease. So we have added sexual health to the nomenclature. And over the last 15 years, I think that we indeed have changed the nomenclature so that sexual health is a commonly used term, although there's still some debate as to precisely what that means. There are several different definitions. And the more important question is, how does that term translate into action? Well, sexual health, part of what's so daunting about it is it's a very broad perspective. It's important that it spans the entire lifespan. It doesn't only address issues related to adolescence, but the entire lifespan. It includes sexual education. It includes family planning. It includes our topic here at this conference, STI HIV management and prevention. It includes reproductive tract care. It also includes issues regarding interpersonal relationships and respect for each other. And as individuals age, their sex and sexuality also begin to evolve. And so it involves things like erectile dysfunction, decreased lubrication, diminished sexual desire, and so forth. As we began to embrace this concept, however, the question was asked again and again, is the sexual health approach too comprehensive to be useful for STD control? I translate that into saying, is it overwhelming? And I think the answer is no. Sexual health is about interpersonal respect, it's about education, and it's also about prioritization. And I think all of the people here at this conference have a contributing role. None of you are going to do it all by yourself, but working together, we can all accomplish it. Because I think sexual health is one part of overall health, and health, I believe, is a human right. More importantly, sexual health is an intervention against stigma. Health is a positive message, and so for the first time, we're beginning to move our messaging regarding sexually transmitted infections from disease, drips, discharges, sores, to something to be sought, not avoided. And that makes all of the conversations a whole lot easier. Sexual health is operational over the entire life course, although how it's presented over the life course varies. And finally, in a time when we have to be more efficient because we can no longer effectively succeed with simply categorical approaches like syphilis control, gonorrhea control, and infertility prevention program, but it provides a big tent in which we can all work together to improve the health of our patients. As I've already said, though, I think the great thing about sexual health is that it is an intervention to reduce stigma. It challenges the conventional wisdom about STIs, all of which I believe are wrong. I do not believe that STIs are the result of inappropriate behavior. I do not believe that people with STIs will know that they have them. I do not believe that STI control should focus only on women. And I do not believe that sex and STIs is not an appropriate topic for conversation. Yet, stigma, shame, and the related issues persist, even in our places where we talk about forgiveness and brotherhood on a regular basis. This is a church in Birmingham, Alabama, where I live. So we're caught in this cycle of stigma and intolerance, which fuel things and which hinder all of the efforts of everybody in this room to address the problem with STIs. That's what I believe sexual health does. I believe that sexual health begins to oppose and address the issues of STI-related stigma, which acts on many levels. For the individuals in our societies and communities, for us as healthcare providers, for populations as a whole. And I apologize for this slide. The text is a little bit small, but let me give you some examples about that. On a personal level, the issues regarding STI-related stigma leads to delays in using or seeking preventive health care. I don't need condoms. I'm not that kind of person. My kids don't need HPV vaccine. Why would they need that? Oh, I don't need to be tested for STIs. I don't worry about those things. It caused delays in seeking care, okay? Oh, that vaginal discharge, maybe too many chili peppers last night, maybe I'm dehydrated, maybe whatever, but it sure couldn't be an STI, could it? And it also compromises partner notification, which is one of the things we need to work on to improve. On a provider basis, it introduces an issue of hesitancy in seeking relevant information, leads to differential testing of our patients, and changes in patient-client interactions, which then go on to infect the entire population. So thinking back, as we use the same tools that Thomas Paine outlined, we can quote Albert Einstein. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Sexual health offers us a chance to change that because sexual health is a frame shift in how we do it. Until we've begun to approach sexual health, we've adopted loss frame efforts, which emphasize risks, harm, disease, drips, discharges, rather than a gain frame perspective, which emphasizes positives and benefits. Let me give you some examples of what I mean by that. What about how we ask questions about partners? Have you ever had homosexual sex? What's the message there versus simply asking, are your partners men, women, or both? Or, in my teaching of medical students, I can't tell you how many times I've heard them or residents say, have you ever had oral, rectal sex, or just regular sex? Instead of saying, when you have sex, which sites are exposed, oral, rectal, or genital? What about in partner notification efforts? We need to find out who gave this to you. Who gave this to you? They could become sterile or they could reinfect you. Instead of simply acknowledging, as is the case, your partner probably did not know that they were infected and could be at risk of complications or infecting others. I would suggest to you that the message here is that the sexual health message is empowering for our patients. It has to do with sex and sexuality over the entire life. It's a stigma intervention, and it broadly encourages preventative health care. And it's a whole lot easier to prevent any and all of these challenges to sexual health than it is to address the problems themselves. It promotes vaccines. It promotes screening. And as healthcare providers, it's permissive because it doesn't exclude people, it reduces consequences and shame, and it's more efficient because it's a broader scope. So let me, as I begin to close, suggest that we should all reflect on some of these things. Have you ever hesitated to take a sexual history? I certainly did earlier in my career. Have you ever hesitated to test for STIs because the client might find it troublesome or insulting? Or this is my own personal sexual health litmus test. Have you ever apologized to a patient for making a diagnosis of chlamydia, trichomoniasis, gonorrhea, HIV? I did, and I'm ashamed that I did because I can't think of any reason why we should be apologizing for finding something that allows our clients and us to do something about the problems we've uncovered. So I would suggest to you in closing that a sexual health approach and framework for all of us is another tool in our efforts to control STI prevention. It's not supposed to replace other efforts. It's supposed to augment them. But as we deal with our patients, as we move forward, this is a client-appropriate approach which will have benefits for many of the patients we serve. So with that, I'll close, and I thank you for your attention.